The chaplain's name, as Walter Moody would discover some 9 hours later, was Cowell Devlin. He had arrived in Hokitika upon the clipper ship Virtue, which was leased and operated by Balfour Shipping, and which had conveyed, along with sundry passengers, timber, iron, fasteners, many tins of paint, assorted dry goods, several crates of livestock, and a great quantity of calico, the now-vanished shipping crate containing Alistair Lauderback's trunk, and inside that, the copy of the contract under which the bark Godspeed had been sold. The Virtue had reached Hokitika 2 days before Alistair Lauderback himself. The Reverend Cowell Devlin had first arrived in Hokitika, therefore 2 days before the death of Crosby Wells. Immediately upon landing, he had reported to the police camp, where the jail's governor, George Shepherd, wasted little time in putting him to work. Devlin's official duties would not begin until the completion of the new Hokitika jailhouse, high on the terrace of Sea View. In the meantime, however, Devlin might make himself useful around the police camp, and help with the daily management of the temporary jail, which was at that time the residence of 2 women and 19 men. Devlin was to teach each one of them to fear their Maker, and to instil in their wayward hearts a proper respect for the iron cladding of the law, or so the jailer phrased it. Devlin would soon discover that he and Shepherd differed very radically in their pedagogic sensibilities. Having taken a brief tour of the police camp and praised the style of its management, Devlin inquired whether he might take his lodging in the jailhouse each night, so as to sleep among the felons and share their bread. The jailer received this proposition with distaste. He did not exactly reject Devlin's inquiry, but he paused, licked his lip with a pale, dry tongue, and then suggested that Devlin might do better to take up residence in one of Hokitika's many hotels. Shepherd went on to warn the chaplain that his Irish accent might invite demonstrations of partisanship from Englishmen, and the expectation of a Catholic sensibility from his fellow Irish. He advised him, finally, to be discerning when choosing his company, and still more discerning when choosing his words. And with this pronouncement, he welcomed Devlin to Hokitika, and promptly bid him good morning. But Cowell Devlin did not have funds enough to support several months' lodging in a hotel, and it was not his habit, furthermore, to indulge another man's pessimism about partisan displays. He did not take Shepherd's advice, and he did not heed his warning. He purchased a standard-issue miner's tent, strung it up some 50 yards from the Hokitika beachfront, and weighted the calico pockets with stones. Then he made his way back to Revel Street, bought a mug of small beer at the most crowded hotel he could find, and began to introduce himself to Englishmen and Irishmen alike. Cowell Devlin was, to all intents and purposes, a self-made man, but because this epithet is rarely used to describe members of the Holy Orders, we ought to clarify its usage here. The cleric spent the present moment in a state of constant visualization, conjuring in his mind the untroubled future self he had determined that he would one day become. His theology, too, followed this pattern. He was a hopeful believer, and to his many disciples he spoke of a utopian future, a world without want. When he spoke, he freely interchanged the language of auspice with the language of dreams. There was no conflict in Cowell Devlin's mind between reality as he wished to perceive it and reality as it was otherwise perceived. Such an inclination might, in the context of another man's temperament, be called ambition. But Devlin's self-image was impregnable, even mythic, and he had long ago determined that he was not an ambitious man. As might be expected, he was given to bouts of very purposeful ignorance, and tended to pass over the harsher truths of human nature in favour of those that could be romanticised by whimsy and imagination. With respect to these latter articles, Devlin was an adept. He was an excellent storyteller, and therefore an effective clergyman. His faith, like his self-image, was complete, equable, and almost clairvoyant in its expression, attributes that, as Balfour had already observed, occasionally made him seem rather smug. At 11 o'clock on the night of the 14th of January, the night that Alistair Lauderback arrived in Hokitika, Cowell Devlin was sitting cross-legged on the floor of the Hokitika jailhouse, speaking with the inmates about Paul. Sometime around sundown it had begun to rain, and the chaplain had decided to stay late, in the hope that the downpour was only a temporary one. for he was new to Hokitika and did not yet understand the dogged persistence of the weather on the coast. The governor was at work in his private study, and his wife abed. The prisoners were mostly awake. They had listened to Devlin's sermon, at first politely, and then with real interest. They were now, at the chaplain's encouragement, offering testimonies and philosophies of their own. Devlin was wondering whether he ought to retire for the night and venture out into the rain, when there came a shout from the courtyard, and a thump against the door. This roused the jailer, who emerged from his study with a linen cap upon his head and a rifle in his hand, a combination that ought to have been amusing, but was not. Devlin rose also, and followed Shepherd to the door. They peered into the rain, and saw, just past the circle of light that was thrown by the jailer's lantern, the duty sergeant Ellis Drake. He had a woman in his arms. Shepherd opened the door wider and invited the sergeant to step inside. Drake was a greasy, nasal fellow of limited intelligence. Hearing his name, one was put in mind not of the naval hero, but of the common duck, a species he closely resembled. He conveyed his captive into the jailhouse by the vulgar method of the fireman's hold, and deposited her with little ceremony upon the floor. He then reported, nasally, that the whore had either committed a crime against society or a crime against God. She had been found in a posture of such abject insensience that a distinction between gross intoxication and willful harm could not be made, but he hoped, tipping his hat, that some hours in the jailhouse might serve to clarify the matter. He nudged her senseless body with the tip of his boot, as if to reiterate his point, and added that the instrument of her crime was likely opium. The whore was enslaved to the drug, and had often been seen in public while under its effects. Governor Shepherd gazed down at Anna Wetherill, and watched her hands curl and clasp at nothing. Devlin, not wanting to act out of turn, awaited the jailer's decision, though he wanted very much to kneel and touch the woman, and check her body for signs of harm. He was greatly saddened by the notion of suicide, and considered it the most dreadful assault upon the soul that any body could possibly make. The three men looked down at the whore, and for a moment no one spoke. Then Drake confided that if he had to make a definitive indictment, he was of the belief that she had attempted the more atrocious crime. The jailer had better wait for her to come around, however, so as to ask the girl himself. Shepherd collected Miss Wetherill's body as he was bid, propped her up against the wall, and shackled her. He ensured that she could breathe and was performing that function tolerably. He then looked at his pocket watch and commented upon the lateness of the hour. Devlin took his cue and donned his hat and coat. Though as he left the jail, he cast a yearning look over his shoulder. He wished that the girl had been arranged more comfortably. But the jailer was bidding him good night, and in the next moment the door had been shut and locked behind him. When Devlin returned to the police camp early the next morning, Anna Wetherill was still unconscious. Her head had lolled sideways, and her mouth was slightly agape. There was a bluish-purple bruise upon her temple, and her cheekbone was painfully swollen. Had she fallen? Or had she been struck? Devlin had no time to investigate, however, or to press the jailer for more information on the circumstances of the girl's arrest. It transpired that a man had died during the night, and Devlin was requested to accompany the physician to the Arahura Valley to assist in the collection of the dead man's remains, and perhaps also to say a prayer or two over his body. The dead man's name, Shepherd informed him, was Crosby Wells. On Shepherd's information, he had died peacefully of age, infirmity, and drink. There was no reason at this stage to suspect homicide. In life, Shepherd went on, Wells had been a hermit. He would be remembered neither as a good nor as a wicked man, for his acquaintances had been few and no family had survived him. The chaplain and the physician drove northward up the beach, and turned inland once they reached the mouth of the Arahura River. Crosby Wells' cottage, situated some 3 or 4 miles upriver, was of simple construction, a timber box beneath a sloping roof of sheet iron, though Crosby Wells had afforded himself the handsome luxury of a glass window set into the north side of the house. The cottage was plainly visible from the Christchurch Road, for it was elevated some 20 feet above the river bank and was surrounded by a cleared plot of land. All in all, the dwelling made for a very lonely picture, and all the more so after the man's corpse had been wrapped in blankets and carried from the room. Every surface was tacky and furred with dust. The bolster was stained yellow, the pillow sprayed with mould. A side of bacon hanging from a rafter was cracked and greasy dry. Empty demijohns of liquor were ranged around the room's perimeter. The bottle on the dead man's table was likewise empty, signifying that the hermit's last action had been to drain his vessel, rest his head on his hands, and sleep. The place had an animal smell, the smell of loneliness, Devlin thought, with sympathy. He knelt before the range and pulled out the ash drawer, intending to build a fire in the stove in order to burn off the dead-seeming odour of the room, and saw a piece of paper trapped between the grating and the bottom of the drawer. It appeared as if someone, Wells presumably, had attempted to burn the document, but had closed the door of the range before the paper caught. The document had only caught fire along one edge before it dropped between the slats of the firebox to the drawer below, and was only very slightly charred. Devlin plucked it out and brushed it clean of ash. It was still legible. On this 11th day of October 1865, a sum of £2,000 is to be given to Miss Anna Wetherill, formerly of New South Wales, by Mr. Emery Staines, formerly of New South Wales, as witnessed by Mr. Crosby Wells, presiding. Next to Wells' name there was a shaky signature, but next to the other man's name only a space. Devlin raised his eyebrows. The deed was therefore invalid, for the witness had signed before the principal, and the principal had not signed at all. Devlin recalled the name Anna Wetherill. This was the whore who had been admitted to the jailhouse late the previous night, drugged with opium. He halted a moment, frowning, and then suddenly folded the deed in half and thrust it between the buttons of his shirt against his skin. He continued building the fire. Presently the physician came back inside, he'd been feeding the horses, and the two men sat and shared a cup of tea, looking out the plate-glass window over the river and to the clouded mountains beyond. Outside, the horses champed at their nosebags and stamped their feet. On the tray of the cart, the blanket covering Wells' body gained a film of beaded silver from the rain. Cowell Devlin could not quite justify his impulse to conceal the deed of gift from the physician, Dr. Gillies. Perhaps, he thought, he had been impelled by the atmosphere of quiet in the dead man's house. Perhaps he had meant the act of suppression as a gesture of respect. Perhaps his curiosity had been aroused by the name Anna Wetherill, the attempted suicide, found unconscious in the Christchurch Road, and he had concealed the paper out of an obscure wish to protect her. The chaplain mused over these various possibilities as he drank his tea. He did not speak to the physician, who was likewise silent. When they were done, they washed their cups, covered the fire, closed the door, and clambered back upon the cart to convey their sorry freight back to the police camp in Hokitika, where a post-mortem was to be conducted upon the dead man's remains. It was characteristic of Cowell Devlin that he would not attach a precise motivation to an action of questionable integrity, and that he chose instead to indulge a kind of dreamy confusion about his motivations as a whole. It was characteristic, too, that he saw no real obligation to confess this action, either then or in the fortnight that followed, for it was not until the night of the 27th of January, 2 weeks later, that he showed this purloined deed of gift to anyone. Devlin believed himself to be a virtuous man, and his self-conception remained, in the face of all contradiction, impregnable. Whenever he behaved badly or questionably, he simply jettisoned the memory and turned his mind to something else. On the way back to Hokitika, he held the deed flat against his chest with the palm of his hand. He spoke only to remark upon the power of the breakers as the surf furled white against the shore beside them. The physician did not speak at all. After they returned to the police camp and had carried Crosby Wells' body inside, Devlin did half-heartedly consider sharing the deed with Governor Shepherd, but he was distracted by a new commotion, and the opportunity expired. Anna Wetherill, it turned out, was beginning to revive. Her eyes fluttered behind their lids, and her tongue shifted in her mouth. She made a murmuring noise. Her fever appeared to have broken, for there was a spray of beaded perspiration on her brow and nose, and the orange silk of her dress had turned brownish at her collar and beneath her arms. Devlin dropped to his knees before her. He clasped her hands in his. They were soft and chill to the touch, and called to Shepherd's wife for water. When at last the girl woke, it was as if from a death. Her head reared back, and her eye rolled forward. She made a rasping noise. She seemed to register where she was, but the after-effects of opium had left her ravaged. Evidently she did not possess the energy even to express surprise. She drew her hands weakly away from Devlin's grasp, and he retreated. He noticed that her hands moved at once to encircle her corset, as though her belly had been punctured, he thought, and she was trying to staunch the wound. He spoke, but she did not respond, and presently she closed her eyes again and drifted back to sleep. An altercation broke out in another quarter of the jailhouse, and Devlin was called over to officiate. This duty and others pertaining to his station claimed his attention for the remainder of the afternoon. At the end of the day, the justice's clerk arrived from the courthouse to collect bail from any miscreant who could raise the necessary sum. At the sound of this newcomer's voice, Miss Wetherill lifted her dark head, made damp by fever, and beckoned. The clerk was another new face in town, slim and very dapper. Gascoin was his name. The whore extracted several coins from between the sorry bones of her corset and pressed them one by one into the clerk's open palm. She was shivering a great deal and wore a look of great humiliation. The bail was recorded as met, and Governor Shepherd was then obligated to release her, which he did promptly. Devlin did not attend her hearing at the magistrate's court the next day, for he had been charged with the task of digging a grave for the hermit, Crosby Wells. He heard later that she had declined to plead, and had paid the fine that was levied against her without argument. The day after the burial, a £4,000 fortune was discovered in Crosby Wells' cottage, exactly twice the sum named in the partially burned deed of gift, which Devlin had since stowed between the pages of his Bible, between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New. Still, Devlin did not confess. Still, he did not show the deed to anyone. He told himself that once Anna Wetherill was stronger, once the episode of her near suicide was safely behind her, he would show the piece of paper to her. For the moment, however, he judged it prudent to keep the information to himself. Now, in the dining room of the Palace Hotel, Devlin reached out and placed his hand over the battered cover of his Bible, which was unmarked except for a small Canterbury cross stamped into the leather in gold. The movement was protective, although he did not yet know that the enclosed deed, pressed apocryphal between Malachi and Matthew, was to be of great importance to Thomas Balfour, as it would be to sundry other men, still he felt the need to keep it close to him. He knew that the deed, receipt of a gift that was never given, codicil to a will that was never made, was valuable somehow, and he was loath to part with it until he knew what its exact value truly was. "Grave digging," said Balfour, taking his derby hat from its hook and running his fingers around the brim. "That's something you'll need to read up on." "I do not know of any tracts on the subject," Devlin said. "For your new parish," said Balfour, ignoring him. "There's a gallows going in." He put his hat on, pushed it back off his forehead with his thumb, and turned to leave. At the door he lingered. "I don't know your name, Reverend," he said.
"And I don't know yours," Devlin returned.
There was a silence, and then Balfour burst out laughing, tipped his hat to show his pleasure, and strode from the room. Saturday in Hokitika was a day of bustle and appointment. The diggers flooded back to the township in droves, swelling the total population to some 4,000, and filling the doss houses and hotels along Revel Street to riotous capacity. The clerks at the magistrate's court were overrun with petty claims and mining rights, the brokers with pledges, the merchants with orders from the rich men and petitions for extended credit from the poor. Gibson Quay was a hive of industry. It seemed that with every hour that passed, a new timber frame was hammered into place, a new door was hung, and a new store unfurled its banner to billow and crack in the Tasman wind. every spoke on the great wheel of luck was visible on a Saturday. There were men rising, risen, just falling, fallen, and at rest. And that night, every digger would either drink his sorrow or his joy. Today, however, the heavy rain had discouraged all but the most urgent traffic in the streets, and Hokitika did not throng with its usual crowd. The few bedraggled men Balfour passed were hunched under the awnings of hotels, cupping their hands to keep their cigarettes alight. Even the horses had an air of grim surrender. They stood, muzzled by the wet cones of their nosebags, unmoving in the torn muck of the road, and as he strode by, they showed not even a flicker in the half-lidded slack of their eyes. As Balfour turned into Revel Street, he met with such a lash of wind and rain that he was obliged to clamp his hat to his head with his hand. According to Saxby's weather warnings, that dubious oracle published daily in the West Coast Times, the deluge would let up within a day or three, for Saxby was expansive in his predictions and allowed himself a generous margin of error on either side of his guess. In truth, the specifics of his column changed but rarely. Downpour was as much a part of the Hokitika constitution as frost and sunburn had been in Otago, and red dust in the Victorian hills. Balfour quickened his pace, pulling his coat tighter around his body with his free hand. There were a dozen-odd men upon the covered veranda of the Reserve Bank, pocketed in groups of three and four. The windows behind them were fogged pearl grey. Balfour scanned the faces, squinting through the rain, but saw nobody he recognised. A ragged plume of smoke directed his gaze downward to a figure sitting alone. A Maori man was squatting under the eave with his back against a piling. He was smoking a cigar. His face was tattooed in a way that reminded Balfour of the wind patterns on a map. Two large swirls gave fullness to his cheeks, and spokes radiated upward from his brows to join his hairline. A pair of deep walls on either side of his nostrils lent an almost prideful definition to his nose. His lips had been coloured blue. He was wearing serge trousers and an open-necked twill shirt, unbuttoned to the sternum. Flat against the brown skin of his chest hung an enormous green pendant shaped like an adze. He had almost finished his cigar, and as Balfour approached, he threw the butt into the thoroughfare, where it rolled down the camber of the road and then came to rest, still reeking, against the wet edge of the grass. "You're that Maori fellow," said Balfour. "Crosby Wells's mate." The man moved his eyes to Balfour's, but did not speak.
"Give us your name again."
"Your name."
"Ko te rau tauwhare toko ingoa."
"Crikey," Balfour said. "Give us just the name part." He held his palms close together to signify a small amount. "Just the name."
"Te rau tauwhare."
"Can't say that either," Balfour said. He shook his head. "Well, what do your friends call you then? Your white man friends? What did Crosby call you?"
"Te rau."
"Not much better, is it?" Balfour said. "I'd be a fool to try, wouldn't I? How about I call you Ted? It's a good British name for you. Short for Theodore or Edward. You can choose. Edward's a nice name." Tauwhare did not respond. "I'm Thomas," Balfour said, placing his hand on his heart. "And you're Ted." He leant over and patted Tauwhare on the crown of his head. The man flinched, and Balfour, in surprise, quickly snatched back his hand and took a step backwards. Feeling foolish, he stuck out his leg and shoved both hands into the pockets of his vest.
"Tamati," said Tauwhare.
"Come again."
"In my tongue, your name is Tamati."
"Oh," Balfour said, very relieved. He took his hands out of his pockets, clapped them together, and then folded his arms. "You've got a bit of English. Good."
"I have a great many English words," said Tauwhare. "I'm told I speak your language very well."
"Crosby teach you a bit of English, Ted?"
"I taught him," said Tauwhare. "I taught him Kōrero Māori. You say Thomas, I say Tamati. You say Crosby, I say Kōrero Mai."
He grinned, showing teeth that were very white and very square. Evidently he had made a joke of some kind, and so Balfour smiled back.
"Never had a head for languages," he said, pulling his coat tighter across his body. "If it's not English, it's Spanish. That's what my old dad always said. Listen, though, Ted, I'm sorry about your mate. I'm sorry about Crosby Wells."
Taufari's expression became sober at once.
"He maumaharatanga," he said.
"Yes, well," Balfour said, wishing that the other man would stop talking in his own tongue. "It was a damn shame, is what it was. And now all this kerfuffle, all this bother about the fortune and so forth, and his wife."
He peered expectantly at Taufari through the rain.
"He paunamu kakanorua," said Terau Taufari.
With his first two fingers, he touched the adz-shaped pendant that hung around his neck. Perhaps it was a talisman of some kind, Balfour thought. They all had them, the Maori fellows. Taufari's was almost the size of his hand, and polished to a shine. It was made of a dark green stone, clouded with bands of a lighter green, and was fitted to a braid that ran around Taufari's neck, so that the narrow end of the adz sat high in the notch of his collarbone.
"Say," Balfour said, opting for a shot in the dark, "say, where were you when it happened, Ted? Where were you when Crosby died?"
Perhaps the Maori fellow could start him on his way. Perhaps he knew something. It wouldn't do to ask too many questions about the town, of course, for fear of attracting suspicion, but a Maori man was a much safer bet than most. His acquaintance was most likely very limited. Te Rau Taufare turned his dark eyes on Balfour and considered him.
"Do you understand the question?" Balfour said.
"I understand the question," Taufare said.
He understood that Balfour was asking about the death of Crosby Wells, and yet had not been present at his funeral. That shameful excuse for a funeral, Taufari thought, with a flash of anger and disgust. He understood that Balfour had made only the most superficial show of sympathy, and had not even removed his hat. He understood that Balfour was looking to make a profit in some way, for he had a greedy look, in the way that men often did when they saw a chance to receive something and give nothing in return. Yes, Taufari thought. He understood the question. Te Rau Taufari was not quite 30 years of age. He was handsomely muscular and carried himself with assurance and the tightly wound energy of youth. Though not openly prideful, he never showed that he was impressed or intimidated by any other man. He possessed a deeply private arrogance, a bedrock of self-certainty that needed neither proof nor explication. For although he had a warrior's reputation and an honourable standing within his tribe, his self-conception had not been shaped by his achievements. He simply knew that his beauty and his strength were without compare. He simply knew that he was better than most other men. This estimation did make Taufari anxious, however. He felt that it pointed to a spiritual dearth. He knew that any self-reflexive certainty was the hallmark of shallowness. And that valuation was no index of true worth, and yet he could not shake his certainty about himself. This worried him. He worried that he was only an ornament, a shell without meat, a hollow clam. He worried that his own self-estimation was a vain one. He therefore apprenticed himself to the spiritual life. He quested after the wisdom of his ancestors so as to teach himself to doubt himself. As a monk seeks to transcend the lesser functions of his body, so did Te Rau Taufari seek to transcend this lesser function of his will. But a man cannot master his will without the expression of it. Taufari could never strike a balance between surrendering to his impulses and fighting them. The iwi to which Taufari belonged was Pautini Ngai Tahu, a people who had once commanded the entire western coast of the South Island, from the steep-sided fjords in the south to the palms and stony beaches in the far north. 6 years ago, the Crown had purchased this extensive tract of land for a sum of £300, reserving for Pautini Ngai Tahu only the Arahura River, sections of its banks, and a small parcel of land at Mafera, the mouth of the River Grey. The negotiations had at the time struck Pautini Ngai Tahu as unfair. Now, 6 years later, they knew the purchase to be patent theft. The thousands and thousands of diggers who had since flocked to the coast in pursuit of gold had each purchased a prospector's license at £1 apiece, and land at a price of 10 shillings per acre. That profit alone was considerable, but that was to say nothing of the value of the gold itself, hidden in the rivers and mingled in the sands, whose aggregate value was so colossal it had not yet been given a figure. Every time he thought about the wealth his people ought to have commanded, Taufari felt a swell of anger in his chest, an anger so bitter and tormented that it manifested as pain. Thus it was to the crown, and not to Pautini Ngai Tau, that Crosby Wells had paid his £50 when he purchased 100 rolling acres at the eastern end of the Arahura Valley, an acreage that was thick with totara, a finely grained wood that answered well to a knife and did not weather under salt or storm. Wells was pleased with his purchase. His two great loves were hard work and hard work's reward, whiskey when he could get it, and gin when he could not. He built himself a one-roomed cottage overlooking the river, cleared a space for a garden, and began to build a timber mill. Te Rau Taufare travelled up the Arahura Valley relatively frequently, for the reason that he was a hunter of Paunamu, and the Arahura River was filled with that treasure. Smooth, milky grey stones that, when split, showed a glassy green interior, harder than steel. He was a competent carver, even, some said, an excellent one, but it was in sourcing the stone from the riverbed that he was truly and uniquely skilled. Paunamu was as dull and ordinary on the exterior as it was bright and iridescent within. Taufare, with his practised eye, did not need to scratch or split the stones at the riverbank, but carried them back to Mahuera untouched, so that they could be blessed and broken in the ceremonial way. The acreage purchased by Crosby Wells banked onto Pautini Ngai Tau land, or as we should properly say, banked onto the portion of land to which Pautini Ngai Tau had been so recently confined. In any event, it was not long before Te Rau Taufare encountered Crosby Wells. Having been attracted by the sound of Wells' axe ringing through the valley as he split kindling for his fire. Their acquaintance began cordially and became frequent. Over time, Taufare began to call in at Crosby Wells' cottage each time he was near. Wells, it turned out, was an enthusiastic pupil of Maori life and lore, and so Taufare's visits became a tradition. Te Rau Taufare loved any chance to enlighten other men upon those qualities that best defined him, and never more than when his audience flattered those aspects of his person about which he cherished a deeply private doubt, namely his Maori, his spirit, his religion, and his depth. Crosby Wells, over the coming months, questioned Taufare relentlessly about his beliefs as a man and as a Maori man of Ngai Tau allegiance. He confessed that Taufare was the first non-European with whom he had ever spoken. His curiosity, so expressed, had all the qualities of thirst. Taufare, it must be said, did not learn a great deal about Crosby Wells during this time. The latter seldom spoke about his own past, and it was not Taufare's habit to ask a great many questions. He considered Crosby Wells a kindred spirit, however, and often told him so. For, like all fundamentally confident persons, Taufare was very happy to compare himself to others, intending all such comparisons as compliments of the most heartfelt kind. On the morning after Crosby Wells' death, Taufare arrived at his cottage with a gift of food, as was their custom. He supplied the meat, and Wells the spirits, an arrangement that satisfied both men. In the clear space before Wells' cottage, he met a cart departing. Holding the reins was the Hokitika physician, Dr. Gillies. Beside him sat the jailhouse chaplain, Cowell Devlin. Taufare did not know either of these men, but when his gaze moved to the cart, he saw a familiar pair of boots, and beneath a folded blanket, a familiar form. Taufare gave a cry and dropped his gift upon the ground in shock. The chaplain, taking pity on him, suggested that he might accompany his friend's body back to Hokitika, where it was to be prepared for burial, and thereafter interred. There was no room for Taufare on the driver's seat, but, if he wished it, he could sit on the rear tongue of the cart, so long as he remembered to keep his feet out of the way. The hoteliers and shopkeepers stood in the doorways along Revel Street as the cart rattled into Hokitika and turned down the main road. Some trotted forward for a better view, peering up at Te Rau Tafare, who stared back, blank-faced, limp. One of his hands was loosely gripping Weld's ankle. The man's body rolled and juddered with each lurch of the cart. When they reached the police camp, Tafare did not move. He sat waiting, still holding Weld's ankle, while the other men conferred. The Hokitika cooper had agreed to knock together a pine coffin ready for the funeral and to fashion a rounded wooden headstone on which he would paint Crosby Wells' name and the two dates that bounded his life. Nobody was sure of the actual year of his birth, but the year 1809 had been inked upon the flyleaf of his Bible. This was a plausible birth date, for it would place Crosby Wells at 57 years of age, and it was this date that the cooper would inscribe on the dead man's wooden headstone. Until these two orders were completed, however, and until the grave was dug, the jail's governor had directed Crosby Wells to be laid out on the floor of his private study at the police camp, with a muslin bedsheet between his body and the ground. When the body was arranged with his hands folded across his chest, the jailer ushered everyone from the room and pulled the door closed, causing the hallway to shiver. The interior walls of the jailer's house were made of patterned calico that had been stretched tight and tacked to the building's frame, and when the timber creaked in the wind or was disturbed by a heavy footfall or the sudden slam of a door, the walls all quivered and rippled like the surface of a pool, so that, watching them tremble, one could not help but call to mind that two-inch space between the doubled cloth, that dead space around the framing, full of dust, and patterned by the moving shadows of the bodies in the room beyond. "Someone has to stay with him," Tafare insisted. Wells could not be left alone, lying on the floor, without even a flame burning in the room, with no one to watch over him, touch him, pray over him, pray for him, or sing. Tafare tried to explain the principles of the tangi, but they weren't principles, they were rites, too sacred for explanation, too sacred even to defend. They were simply the way things ought to be done, must be done. "A spirit has not fully departed until the body is interred," he said. "There are songs and prayers." The jailer reprimanded him, calling him a heathen. Tafare became angry. "Somebody has to stay with him until the burial," he said. "I will stay with him until the burial. Crosby Wells was my friend and my brother." "Crosby Wells," the jailer returned, "was a white man, and unless a passing shadow has deceived me, certainly no brother of yours. The funeral will be on Tuesday morning. If you want to make yourself useful, you can lend a hand to the digging of his grave." But Tafare stayed. He kept vigil on the porch, and then in the garden, and then in the alley between the jailer's cottage and the camp, and from each station he was chased away. At last, the jailer emerged from the jailhouse with a long-handed pistol in his hand. He would shoot Tafare if he saw him within 50 yards of the camp at any hour before the moment Crosby Wells' body was lowered into the ground, so help him God, he said. So Tafare backed up 50 paces, counting the steps, and sat down against the wooden facade of the Grey and Buller Bank. From this distance he watched over his old friend's body and spoke beloved words for him on the final night before his spirit sailed away.
"When Crosby died," said Tafare, "I was in the Arahura."
"You were in the valley," said Balfour. "You were there when he died?"
"I was sitting a trap for Kiriru," said Tafare. "Do you know Kiriru?"
"Some kind of bird, is it?"
"Yes. Very tasty. Good for stewing."
"All right."
Balfour's derby hat had begun to drip. He took it off and banged it against his leg. Already his suit had darkened from grey to a sodden charcoal. His shirt had become translucent, showing through it the pink of his skin.
"I set the trap before nightfall to catch the birds in the morning," Tafare said. "From the ridge you can see Crosby's house, from above. That night 4 men went in."
"Four?" said Balfour, replacing his hat. "You don't mean 3. One man on a black stallion, very tall. Two other men with him, shorter, both on bay mares. That's Alistair Lauderback and Jock and Augustus. The men who found his body, you know, who alerted the police.
I saw three men on horseback, yes, said Taufari, nodding slowly. But before they arrived, I saw one man on foot.
One man alone? Well, you're all right, aren't you, Ted? Said Balfour, suddenly very excited. Yes, by golly, you're all right.
I was not alarmed, Taufari continued, because I did not know that Crosby Wills died that night. I did not know he was dead until the morning.
One man entering the cottage alone, said Balfour.
He began to pace.
And before Lauderback arrives.
Do you wish to know his name?
Balfour wheeled on his foot.
You know who it was?
He was almost shouting.
Yes, good Lord, tell me.
We will trade, said Taufari immediately. I will set my price. You will count her. £1.
Trade, said Balfour.
£1, said Taufari.
Hang tight, said Balfour. You saw a man go into Wells' cottage on the day of his death, the very day of his death, 2 weeks ago. You really saw somebody do that? And you know, without a shadow of a doubt, who that man was?
I know the name, said Taufari. I know the man. No cheating.
No cheating, agreed Balfour. But before I pay, I want to make sure that you do really know him, you see. I want to make sure you're not taking me for a ride. Big man, was it? Very dark hair.
Taufari folded his arms.
Fair play, he said. No cheating.
Of course it's fair play, said Balfour. Of course it is.
We will trade. I have set my price at £1. Now you counter.
Heavy? Was he heavy? Thick set? I'm just making sure, you see. I'm making sure you're on the level. Then I'll start trading. You might be cheating me.
£1, said Taufari stubbornly.
It was Francis Carver, wasn't it, Ted? Isn't that right? It was Francis Carver, the sea captain? Captain Carver?
Balfour was guessing, but it was a good guess. A wounded look passed over Taufari's face, and he exhaled audibly.
I said no cheating, he said, in a tone of reproof.
I wasn't cheating, Ted, said Balfour. I just knew it already, you see. I'd only forgotten. Of course, Carver made a trip up to Crosby Wells' cottage that day. That was him, wasn't it? Captain Carver, the man you saw. You can tell me. It's not a secret, because I already know.
He searched the man's face, making sure. Taufari's jaw was rigidly set. Under his breath, he muttered,
Kite tuo hukoi, me maunga teite.
Well, Ted, you've done me a damned good turn here, and I won't forget it, said Balfour.
By now, he was thoroughly saturated.
And you know, if I ever need something done, I'll come to you, won't I? And you'll get your coin some other way.
Taufari lifted his chin.
You need Maori, he said.
He did not phrase it as a question.
You need Maori. You come to me. I do not do odd jobs. But you need language, and I will teach you many things.
He did not mention that his skill was as a carver. He had never sold Paunamu. He would not sell Paunamu, for one could not put a price upon a treasure, just as one could not purchase mana, and one could not make a bargain with a god. Gold was not a treasure, this Taufari knew. Gold was like all capital, in that it had no memory. Its drift was always onward, away from the past.
All right, but you'll shake, won't you?
Balfour seized Taufari's dry hand in his wet one and shook it vigorously.
There's a good man, Ted. There's a good man.
But Taufari was still looking severely displeased, and he withdrew his hand from Balfour's grip as soon as he was able. Balfour felt a twinge of regret. It would not do to make an enemy of the fellow. Not with so much of this business yet unsolved, he thought. There was a chance that he knew something about the relations, whatever they were, between Crosby Wells and Francis Carver, or between those two men and Lauderback, come to think of it. Yes, it would be useful to keep the man appeased. Balfour reached into his pocket. Surely he had something small, some token. They were fond of tokens. His fingers found a shilling and a sixpence. He pulled the sixpence out. "Here," he said. "You can have this, if you tell me some Maori. Just like you taught Crosby Wells, eh, Ted? Then we'll have done business just as you wanted to. All right. Then we'll be friends. Then you won't be able to complain." He pressed the silver piece into the other man's palm. Tafari looked at it. "Now tell me," said Balfour, rubbing his hands together. "What does hokitika mean? Hokitika. Just the one word, that's all I'm after. And I'd call that a tidy price, by the by. A sixpence for a single word. I'd call that a song."
Te Rau Tawhare sighed. Hokitika. He knew the sense of it, but could not translate. This happened so often between the languages, English and Maori. The words of one tongue never found their exact equivalent in the other, just as there was no white man's herb that one might perfectly exchange for puha, and no white man's bread that exactly called to mind rewena pararoa. However close the flavour, there was always something approximated, something imagined, or something lost. Crosby Wells had understood this. Te Rau Tawhare taught him korero Māori without using any English at all. They used their fingers to point and their faces to mimic, and when Te Rau said things that Crosby Wells did not understand, he let the sounds wash over him like prayers until their meanings clarified and he could see inside the word.
"Hokitika," said Balfour.
He wiped the rain from his face.
"Come on, mate."
At last, Tawhari lifted his finger and described a circle in the air. When his fingertip returned to the place from which he had begun, he jabbed his finger sharply to mark the place of return. But one cannot mark a place upon a circle, he thought. To mark a place upon a circle is to break it, so that it is not a circle any longer.
"Understand it like this," he said,
regretting that he had to speak the words in English and approximate the noun.
"Around, and then back again, beginning."
The Reserve Bank was always very crowded on a Saturday at noon. Diggers stood about with their hands full of gold. The Libra scales rattled up and down as the ore was measured and recorded. The junior bankers ran back and forth from the archives, checking claim papers, marking tax payments, and receiving fees. Along the wall that faced the street were four barred cubicles where the bankers sat. Above them hung a gilt-framed chalkboard, upon which was written that week's yield in ore, with subtotals for each district, and a grand total for the Hokitika region as a whole. Whenever a sum of raw gold was banked or bought, the chalked numbers were erased and then totaled anew, typically to a murmur of appreciation from the men in the room, and occasionally, if the total was a remarkable one, to a round of applause. When Balfour entered the bank, the attention of the crowd was focused not upon this chalkboard, but upon the long table opposite, where the gold buyers, identifiable by the bright copper satchels that they wore upon their belts, inspected the raw ore for purchase. The buyer's work was slow. He weighed each nugget in his hand, scratched and tested the metal for impurities, and examined it through a jeweler's loop. If the ore had been sifted, he filtered it through sieves of matting to check the flakes had not been cut with grit or gravel, and sometimes shook glistering handfuls over plates of mercury to ensure that the metals bonded as they should. Once he declared the stuff pure and fit to be valued, the digger in question shuffled forward and was asked to state his name. The Libra scales were then calibrated until the arm hung parallel with the desk, and then the buyer poured the digger's pile of gold into the left-hand tray. To the right-hand tray, the buyer added cylinder weights, one by one, until finally the scales lurched and the tray bearing the man's fortune shuddered and swung free. That morning, there was only one buyer present, a slick-haired magnate wearing a pale green hunting jacket and a yellow tie, a gaudy combination, and one that might have served to mark him rather too obviously as a moneyed man,
had he been doing business alone and unprotected. But the Hokitika Gold Escort was on hand. This small army, a uniformed infantry of 10 men, presided over every sale and purchase of the colour. Later they would oversee the bullion's transfer into an armoured van and ensure that it was safely conveyed offshore. They stood behind the buyer and flanked the desk at which he sat, each man armed with a 577 Snyder Enfield rifle, a massive, gleaming piece of the most modern design. It took a cartridge as long as a man's index finger and could blow a fellow's head to bloody dust. Balfour had admired the Snyder Enfield when the model was first shipped in, but seeing 10 armed men in this enclosed space gave him an anxious premonition. The room was so crowded he doubted any one guard could find the room to raise his weapon to his shoulder, let alone discharge a round. He shouldered his way through the diggers to the banker's cubicles. Most of the men in the room were present as spectators only, and so parted to admit him. It was in very little time at all, therefore, that Balfour found himself at a barred cubicle, facing a young man in a striped vest and a neatly pinned cravat.
"Good morning. I'm wanting to know if a man named Francis Carver has ever taken out a miner's right in New Zealand," Balfour said. He removed his hat and slicked back his wet hair, an action without a perceptible benefit, for the palm of his hand was very wet also.
"Francis Carver? A captain, Carver?"
"That's the man," said Balfour.
"I'm obliged to ask who you are, and why you are requesting this information."
The banker spoke without effect, and in a mild tone of voice.
"The man owns a ship, and I'm in the shipping trade," Balfour said smoothly, replacing his hat. "Tom Balfour's my name. I'm looking to set up a side venture of a kind. Tea trading, back and forth from Canton. Just canvassing the idea at this point. I want to find out a bit more about Carver before I make any offers of business. Where his money's spread, whether he's ever been bankrupted, that kind of thing."
"Surely you could just ask Mr. Carver yourself,"
replied the banker, speaking in the same inoffensive tone, so that the remark did not come off as rude, but merely as pleasantly offhand. He might have been passing a broken wagon in the street and observing quite affably that there was a very simple way to mend the axle. Balfour explained that Carver was at sea and could not be contacted. The banker seemed unsatisfied with this explanation. He considered Balfour and put his finger against his lower lip. Evidently, however, he could not conjure a further objection that might give him reason to decline to pursue Balfour's request. He nodded, pulled his ledger towards him, and wrote a note in a thin, precise script. He then blotted his page, a little unnecessarily, Balfour thought, for the ledger remained open, and dried the nib of his pen with a square of soft leather.
"Wait here, please," he said.
He disappeared through a low doorway, beyond which lay an antechamber of some kind, and soon returned carrying a large folder, bound in leather, and marked on its spine with the letter C. Balfour drummed his fingers as the banker untied the clasp upon the folder and opened it. He scrutinised the young man through the bars of the grill. What a contrast this young man posed to the Maori in the street. They were rough contemporaries in age, but where Taufari had been muscled, tense and proud, this fellow was languid, even cat-like. He moved with a kind of casual luxury, as though he saw no need to spend his strength on swiftness, and nor did he see any reason to conserve it. He was lean in body. His hair was brown in hue, long and curly at the tips. He wore it tied in a ribbon at the nape of his neck, in the fashion of a whaler. His face was broad, and his eyes spaced widely. His lips were full, his teeth very crooked, and his nose rather large. These features conspired to form an expression that was both honest and nonchalant, and nonchalance is a form of elegance when it demands much and declines to reveal its source. Balfour considered him a very elegant young man.
"Here," the banker said at last, pointing. "You see? Carswell, here, and then Cassidy. Your man's not here."
"So Francis Carver doesn't own a miner's right?"
"Not in Canterbury, no."
He shut the folder with a soft thud.
"What about an Otago certificate?"
"I'm afraid you'll have to go to Dunedin for that."
This was a dead end. In Lauderback's story, the gold in the crate had hailed, allegedly, of course, from Dunstan, which was an Otago field.
"You don't keep records of Otago men?" Balfour asked, disappointed.
"No."
"What if he came in on Otago papers? Would there be a record at the custom house from when he first arrived?"
"Not at the custom house," said the banker, "but if he made any dust, he'd have to have it counted and weighed before he left. He's not allowed to transfer it to another province or out of the country without declaring it first. So he'd come here. We'd ask to take a look at the miner's right. Then we'd make a record in this book that he was working under Otago papers, but on a Hokitika claim. There's nothing in this book. Therefore, as I said just now, we can safely assume he hasn't prospected anywhere hereabouts. As for whether he's prospected in Otago, I've no idea."
The banker spoke with the controlled alarm of a bureaucrat who was requested to explain some mundane feature of the bureaucracy of which he is a functioning part. Controlled, because an official is always comforted by proof of his own expertise, and alarmed, because the necessity for explanation seemed in some obscure way to undermine the system which had afforded him that expertise in the first place.
"All right," said Balfour. "Now, there's one more thing. I need to know whether Carver has owned shares in any mining company or if he took out shares on a private claim."
A flicker of doubt disturbed the banker's mild expression. For the briefest moment, he said nothing, and again it seemed as if he were trying to think of a reason to decline Balfour's request, to declare it unorthodox, or to press to know the reason why. He looked at Balfour with a gaze that was no less piercing for its mildness, and Balfour, who was always made uncomfortable by scrutiny, scowled very darkly. But, as before, the banker applied himself to the task demanded of his office. He wrote another note upon his ledger, blotted it, and then politely excused himself to pursue this new request. When he returned with the shares records, however, he looked openly uneasy.
"Francis Carver has speculated in this area," he said. "You wouldn't call it a portfolio, it's only one claim. Looks like a private agreement. Carver takes home a return to the tune of 50% of the mine's net profit every quarter."
50%? Balfour said. "And only one claim? That's confidence for you. When did he buy?"
"Our records show the date as July 1865.
"That far back?" Balfour said. 6 months ago. But that was after the sale of the Godspeed, was it not? Which claim is it? Who's owning?"
"The mine is called the Aurora," said the banker, enunciating very carefully. "It is owned and operated by..."
"Emery Staines," Balfour finished for him, nodding his head. "Yes, I know the place, up Canieri way. Why, that's capital news. Staines is a great friend of mine. I'll go and talk to the man myself. Thank you very much, Mr. Frost." "Thank you very much, Mr. Frost. You've been extraordinarily helpful." But the banker was looking at Balfour with a strange expression on his face.
"Mr. Balfour," he said, "perhaps you haven't heard."
"Something about Staines?"
"Yes."
Balfour stiffened.
"He's dead."
"No," said Frost. "He vanished."
"What? When?"
2 weeks ago."
Balfour's eyes went wide.
"I am sorry to be the one to break the news, if you are his great friend."
Balfour did not notice the barb of emphasis in the banker's remark.
"Vanished? 2 weeks back," he said. "And no one's talking? Why haven't I heard about it?"
"I assure you that many men have been talking," said Frost. "A notice has been published in the missing persons column every day this week."
"I never read the personals," said Balfour.
But of course, he had been with Lauderback this fortnight past, facilitating introductions up and down the coast.
He had not been frequenting the Corinthian, as he habitually did in the evenings, to share a mug of beer with the other camp followers while they exchanged the local news.
"Perhaps he found a strike," he said now. "That could be it. Perhaps Staines found a paying seam up in the bush somewhere, and he's keeping it quiet until he's staked the ground."
"Perhaps,"
the banker said courteously, and would not say more. Balfour chewed his lip.
"Vanished," he said. "I can't understand it."
"I rather wonder whether this news will be of import to your partner," said Frost, smoothing the open page of his ledger with his palm.
"Who's my partner?" Balfour said, with some alarm, thinking that the banker was referring to Alistair Lauderback, whose name he had been careful not to use.
"Why, Mr. Carver,"
Frost said, blinking,
"your prospective partner in business, as you have just informed me, sir. Mr. Carver has a joint investment with Mr. Staines, so if Mr. Staines is dead..."
He trailed off with a shrug. Balfour narrowed his eyes. The banker seemed to be implying, however vaguely, that Carver was in some way responsible for Emery Staines' disappearance, an implication for which he surely did not have any proof. His attitude was very clear, and yet he had not really expressed an opinion of any kind upon which he might be faulted. The tone of his voice implied that he did not like Carver, even though his words expressed sympathy for the man's possible loss. Balfour, feeling the cowardice of this equivocation, almost became angry, but then he remembered that he was shamming. He was not going into business with Carver, and need not take his part in an argument against him. But then young Frost smothered a smile, and Balfour saw, with a sudden rush of indignation, that in fact the younger man was mocking him. Frost had not believed his false story for a moment. He knew that Balfour was not going into business with Carver. He knew that this falsehood had been fabricated to mask some other purpose. And then he added the insult of diminishment to the injury of exposure by finding Balfour amusing. It rankled Balfour to be second-guessed, but it rankled him still more to be ridiculed, especially by a man whose days were spent in a 3-foot-square cubicle signing checks in another man's name. This last was Lauderback's phrase, half remembered from earlier that morning. It came to Balfour's mind as his own. Suddenly angry, he leant forward and curled his hands around the bars of the grill. "All right," he said quietly. "You listen. I'm no more going into business with Carver than you are. I think the man's a thug and a crook and all the rest of it. I'm up against him, damn it. I've got to get a twinkle on him. Something I can use."
"What is a twinkle?" the banker asked.
"Well, it's stupid. Never mind it," Balfour snapped. "The point is that I'm looking to round him up. Give him over to the law. I think he skimmed a fair fortune out of some other fellow's claim. Thousands. But it's only a hunch, and I need hard evidence. I need a place to start, all right? That investment story I gave you just now was a bunch of guff. Cock and bull."
He glared at the banker through the bars of the grill.
"What?"
he said after a moment.
"What then?"
"Nothing at all," said Frost.
He squared the papers on his desk and gave a cryptic, tight-lipped smile.
"Your business is your own. I wish you only luck, Mr. Balfour."
The news about Emery Staines had rattled Balfour severely. Shipping crates and blackmail was one thing, he thought, but a person disappearing was quite another. That was a somber business. Emery Staines was a good digger and much too young to die. Outside the courthouse, Balfour stood and breathed heavily for a moment. The small crowd outside the bank had dispersed to their luncheon, and the Maori man was gone. The rain had thinned to a persistent drizzle. Balfour cast his eye up and down the street, somewhat at a loss for where next to go. He felt excessively dejected. Vanished, he thought. But one did not simply vanish. The boy could only have been murdered. There was no other explanation for it, if he had not been seen for 2 weeks. Emery Staines was easily the richest man south of the Black Sands. He owned more than a dozen claims, several of which had shafts that descended to depths of 30 feet at least. Balfour, who admired Staines exceedingly, would have guessed his age at 3 or 4 and 20, not so young as to be unworthy of his luck, and not so old as to suggest that he might have acquired it by some less than honest means. In fact, such a suggestion had never crossed Balfour's mind. Staines had been gifted with a thoroughly good-natured beauty, the kind that is earnest and hopeful without ever declaring itself to be so. In temper, he was affable, optimistic, and delightfully quick. Even to think him dead was hateful. To think him murdered was worse. Just then, the Wesleyan chapel bell struck 12:30, releasing a flurry of birds. They burst out of the makeshift belfry and scattered, dark against the sky. Balfour turned his face to the sound, feeling as he did so a sudden ache in his temple. His senses were turning from dull to sharp, the effects of the spirits he had consumed that morning, and the responsibilities of his situation had begun to weigh heavy upon him. He no longer felt inclined to ask questions on Lauderback's behalf. He wrapped his coat around his body, turned on his heel, and began walking towards the Hokitika spit, a place that was, for him, a habitual refuge. It was his pleasure to stand on the sand in foul weather, clutch his coat across his body, and look out past the clustered masts of the ships at anchor, swaying en masse, impelled variously by the river's rushing current, the surf, and the wind, the howling Tasman wind that stripped the bark from the trees at the beachfront and bent the scrub to crippled forms. Balfour enjoyed the fierce indifference of a storm. He liked lonely places because he never really felt alone. As he slithered down the muddy bank to the quay, the wind suddenly dropped. Smiling, Balfour peered into the mist. The rain had stolen all chance of a reflection from the wide mouth of the river, and the water was as grey and opaque as a pewter plate. The bucking masts had slowed their motion when the wind died away. Balfour watched them, calmed by their weighty roll back and forth, back and forth. He waited until they were almost still before moving on. The quay curved around the mouth of the river to meet the spit, a narrow finger of sand that was battered on one side by the white surf of the open ocean and lapped on the other by the confused wash of the river, its waters mingled now with salt and stripped of gold. Here, on the calm side of the spit, a short wharf projected from the quay. Balfour stepped down onto it, landing with a flat sole, and the structure shuddered beneath his weight. Two stevedores, quite as sodden as he was, were sitting on the wharf some 20 feet away. They started at the jolt and turned. "All right, chaps," said Balfour.
"All right, Tom."
One was carrying a brass-capped boat hook. He had been using it to swipe at the gulls, which were diving for their supper on the rocks below, and now he resumed this idle purpose. The other was keeping score. Balfour strolled up behind them, and for a time nobody spoke. They watched the moored vessels pitch back and forth and squinted out through the rain. "You know what the trouble is," Balfour said presently. "Down here, any man can make himself over, make himself new. What's an alias, anyway? What's in a name? Pick it up as you pick up